You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Brookings this evening. Thank you for joining us. I'm Martin Indyk, the director of the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings, of which the Center for the U.S. and Europe is part, and it's the Center for the U.S. and Europe that is hosting this and the seven previous Raymond Aron lectures. Launched first in 2004, when the Center for the U.S. and Europe first was established out of what was then the program on France at Brookings. From that time to this, we've enjoyed a working relationship with the policy planning staff of the French Foreign Ministry and the support of the French Foreign Ministry for the work that we do on France, and for that we're very grateful. Since the series was launched around the time of the centenary of Raymond Aron's birth, that was seen to us a good reason for naming the series after him. But the real reason for naming it after him was actually that he, of course, is a great scholar, was great writer, philosopher, intellectual, and pundit. He thereby provides a very interesting and important example for this lecture series, in which we bring together distinguished French and American scholars, practitioners, and experts to address the burning issues of the time that both France and the United States have an abiding interest in. We've had a wealth of distinguished speakers since 2004, including Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, Pierre Hussner, Stanley Hoffman, Hubert Védrine, Tony Judt, the late Tony Judt, Thérèse Delpech, and many others. In the last 2 years, the Raymond Aron lecture has focused on economic issues. Last year, those of you who are here will remember, François Bourguignon and Kamal Dervis talked about the global economic crisis. While the crisis remains very much at the heart of current problems facing the transatlantic community, nevertheless, 2011 was also the year of another profound development, potentially tectonic shift in the world, and that was, of course, the Arab awakenings. And to help us interpret those Arab awakenings, we're very honored to have two distinguished and highly qualified speakers tonight. To deliver the Raymond Aron lecture, we're very pleased to welcome Professor Olivier Roy. Back in January 2011, he was one of the first of the great experts to argue for the need to get on the right side of history and support the change, the democratic change that he understood would spread across the Arab world from Tunisia. He has argued that the Arab uprisings constitute the first post-Islamist revolutions, but recent events in elections in Egypt and Tunisia appear to lead in a different direction, and we'll be very interested to hear how he interprets developments there, recent developments there. Olivier Roy is a leading French scholar of Islam and Middle East politics. He is a senior researcher at the French National Center for Scientific Research and a professor at the School of Higher Studies in the Social Sciences, and he currently serves at the European University Institute in Florence, where he directs its Mediterranean program. A philosopher by training, Olivier became a specialist in Afghanistan, where he spent a good deal of time in the 1980s, traveling, doing field research, as well as on Iran. From there, he burgeoned out to become a specialist of Islam in the Middle East, and he is today one of the world's leading specialists in those areas. among his many books, including on Afghanistan and Iran in the 1980s and 90s, is The Failure of Political Islam, Globalized Islam, and Holy Ignorance, When Religion and Culture Part Ways, which was published last year by Columbia University Press. He has combined both expertise and academic specialization with fieldwork, and his experience as consultant for the UN Office of the Coordinator in Afghanistan, as well as heading the OSCE mission in Tajikistan, has placed him very well to be able to comment on current developments. After Olivier Roy delivers the lecture, Tom Friedman will offer a response. Tom hardly needs an introduction to this audience, but I'll give him one anyway, because I suspect he, like me, would like one. He is, of course, the New York Times columnist, thrice Pulitzer Prize winner. He actually holds a degree in Mediterranean Studies from Brandeis University, where I first met him when he was a student there, and spent semesters abroad at the American University in Cairo. So when he was appointed correspondent in Beirut for UPI in 1978 and then became the Beirut bureau chief for the New York Times in 1982, it reflected a long-time interest and passion for all things Middle Eastern. In 1984, he was transferred from Beirut to Jerusalem, where he served as the bureau chief for the Times in Israel, and of course that From Beirut to Jerusalem became the title of his famous award-winning bestseller book. He was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 1983 for international reporting from Lebanon, and in 1988 for international reporting from Israel, and he won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for commentary in the New York Times. And in 2005, he was elected as a member of the Pulitzer Prize board. Does that mean you're not allowed to win the prize anymore? It's a far better thing that you do. As well as From Beirut to Jerusalem, he's written a number of best-selling books that have become legends in their time. The Lexus and the Olive Tree, The World is Flat, and most recently with Michael Mandelbaum, That Used to Be Us, a terribly nostalgic book about how America fell behind in the world and what we can do to come back. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Olivier Roy to deliver the 8th Raymond Aron Lecture.
Thank you very much. It's a big honor for me to be here with all of you. And so, of course, the topic of today is a very hot topic, and there is a lot of debate about that and a lot of controversy. So I will go directly to the important facts. First, I think that what did happen under the name of the Arab Spring is irreversible. We are now facing a new stage, a new situation. Of course, there is something paradoxical, you know, because after what looked like a revolution, the Arab Spring, we have, in fact, in power, old elites, old political elites. You know, the Islamists have been on the political scene for decades, and almost all the present leaders are, well, quite old people who have decades of political activities. So they do not represent the new generation which demonstrated on the streets almost a year ago. So we can see that if there has been a revolution, it's not the revolutionaries who are now in power. It's, on the contrary, more conservative, even traditionalist people, whatever their political background, the army or the Islamists. You know. They are people, in a sense, people of the past. But can they open a new era where Islamism could be reconciliated with a democracy? I think so. Because the societies of the Middle East have changed. We have a deep social, cultural, and religious change. And the consequence is that the actual leaders, either transitional or the people who have been elected through the first three elections in Tunisia, for instance, they are being reshaped, you know, recast by the new political scene. They didn't contribute to build this political scene, at least at the beginning. You know, they joined the movement lately. And sometimes in Egypt, for instance, the Muslim Brothers were quite reluctant, you know, to enter into the movement at the beginning for different reasons. But they have to adapt to this new political landscape. And they have to recast the reference to the centrality of Islam in a new context. What is the new context? They do not have the monopoly of Islam. And I will go a bit more in depth about that later. They have to build political coalition with a lot of potential candidates. You know, in Tunisia, they have chosen to build a political coalition with leftist nationalists, if I can qualify this way, the new president. They have to deliver, the Muslim Brothers, the Islamists, they have to deliver on economics, on good governance, and on stability. They are under watch from the streets, you know. There are demonstrations, not the same way in Tunisia and in Cairo. But in Tunisia, there are people demonstrating daily. And among these people, there are people who voted for Nahda. It's not the opponents who are now demonstrating in Tunisia. It's precisely the people who voted for this new coalition and who want to have, you know, results, who want to have a progress. The Islamists are under, I won't say control, but under watch of their own electorate, but also under the watch of the external world, you know. And they care about that. It's something important, you know. It's a big difference, for instance, with the Islamic Revolution of 79, where the revolutionaries took the power, didn't care to build coalition, engaged immediately in a true revolution, and tried to export the revolution into the Middle East, and did confront the superpowers of the time, you know. There is nothing like that now in the Arab Spring and now in the Islamist electoral wave. They have been elected on a domestic agenda and not on a revolutionary agenda. In fact, their electorate is quite conservative. It's not a revolutionary electorate. So there was a revolution, but as I said, a revolution without revolutionaries. The young guys who were at the forefront of the Arab Spring didn't care, didn't want, you know, to enter directly into politics. They didn't endeavor to build political parties and to promote some sort of a new program of government. They just want to stay outside the government, to watch what the government is doing, to put pressure on the government, but they don't want to indulge into daily politics. So this is something which is rather new. So I think that the Islamists are constrained by this new political scene, that they are becoming Democrats, but that they are not liberal. No. They are very conservative. They have a conception of the society which is a majoritarian conception, you know, the idea that the majority should impose, could impose, you know, its views on the society. Even if, as for the Christian in Egypt, they recognize, you know, minority rights, but as a minority, which is something important. But many of their liberal opponents, in Tunisia, for instance, but also in some quarters in other countries, are not specifically Democrat. You know, many Tunisian secularists, for instance, are rejecting, in fact, the elections, either claiming that there was fraud or that the people is too backward, too religious, to be really democratic. So we have this contradiction between democracy and liberalism, you know, which is a key general feature of this movement. Why did I say that the Arab Spring is irreversible? For me, there are three main changes in depth, you know, in the Arab societies. First, there is a new generation. The demographic patterns have changed during the last 20 years. The fertility rate everywhere has dropped. No. Tunisia has a lower fertility rate than France, for instance, now. So the present young generation is a numerous generation, of course, but it's a last numerous generation. They marry later, they have less children, there are more gender equality among them in terms of education, in terms of age of marriage, for instance, you know. So they are less connected to big families, to extended families. They have less children when they have children. They are more connected. They are more global. They often understand and speak foreign languages. You know. They are informed. You know. And they don't follow, you know, the traditional patriarchal society, precisely patriarchal culture, precisely because the social patriarchal structures are now down, you know, are not working anymore. They are more educated than their parents. You know. They know better than their parents. So the traditional fatherly figure of the great leader doesn't work anymore. You know. They are not attracted by charismatic leaders. It's a generation of peers, you know, not of great leaders. And so the consequence is that, and this is the consequence, there is a collapse of the traditional, well, traditional, it's a big word, but of the traditional Arab political culture, you know, based on a charismatic figure or on the son, you know, usually sons are less charismatic than their fathers. But still, you know, the idea was that there was a legitimate, big, great leader and that the people was supposed to be united, you know, under any kind of ideology, nationalism, pan-Islamism, pan-Arabism, it doesn't matter, you know. And that democracy was a foreign more than a foreign, democracy was a Western plot to destroy the unity of the Arab people. All that is finished now. All that is done. They believe in democracy, not in cultural terms, but as something universal. They don't care about, you know, following non-traditional patterns. They don't believe in a Western plot to undermine Arab nationalism. They don't buy the propaganda. They don't stick to traditional ideologies, either pan-Arabic ideologies, nationalist ideologies, or Islamic ideologies. They are far more individualistic. You know? And hence, they call for dignity, not for honor. You know? Honor is a collective reference, but for dignity, an individual right. You know? They want good governance and citizenship. So it's a new political culture. Of course, it's not the whole society which has experienced, you know, these changes. These youngs are in a time of crisis in a minority. You know? And it's clear that when elections come, there is some sort of a conservative backlash from the majority of the population, because many people are afraid, you know, of going too far, are afraid of instability, are afraid, you know, of losing tourists, of seeing the economy being disturbed and possibly destroyed. You know. But this new generation, by definition, you know, will have more and more influence in society during the next decades. So they are the people of the future. You know. And their ideas are pervading, you know, now the whole society. Another factor, which is very important, a third factor of change, is about religion. You know. And this is, I think, the main misunderstanding about the Arab Spring, the main misunderstanding in the West. There has been a wrong premise for, I would say, decades about democratization of Muslim societies. The premise was to any democratization in a Muslim society should be preceded by either a wave of secularization or some sort of religious reform. You know, without reform or reformation of Islam or without secularism, democracy is not possible. And the consequence was very simple, because all the indicators, you know, showed that, in fact, religion was spreading. You know, we all know that religion has been more and more visible during the last 40 years in the Middle East, you know, more and more pervasive among the population. Then the consequence was the conditions are not met to have a democratization of Muslim societies. And this is a big mistake, you know, for different reasons. The issue is not religion. The issue is not theology. You know. In Christianity, we have the same theology for 20 centuries, and a lot of political translation of religion. You know. There is no link between theological reform and political reform, except after 200 years political scientists. Okay, we try to find some connections between Luther Reformation and democratization in Europe. But, you know, Martin Luther was not a liberal, huh? And even he was not a Democrat, and he was not interested by democracy. So the issue is not to have first a political religious reformation in order to have a democratization process. The issue here is not about theology, it's about religiosity. By religiosity, I mean the way people experience the relationship to religion, the way they experience their faith. And during the last two decades, me and other, you know, researchers, we observed precisely a transformation of religiosity. By that, I don't mean a liberalization, but an individualization and diversification of the religious field. The stress is on individual belief, on individual faith. You know. And the stress is also on the possibility to choose. You know. The born-again phenomena is also a Muslim phenomena. And when we speak about a born-again, it's always about somebody who is breaking with the tradition, somebody who doesn't consider that religion is something traditional, something inherited from his or her parents. He thinks, or she thinks, that religion is something which precisely has to be saved from traditions, saved from culture, saved from the social inertia. And this new religious activist tried, you know, for the best or for the worst, that's another issue, to rebuild faith communities outside the framework of a traditional kinship, traditional social bonds. You know. So what appeared as fundamentalism was in fact some sort of transformation of religiosity, of individualization of religiosity. And this is congruent with the quest for citizenship. You know. This is congruent with the idea that at the core of the society, the issue is individual freedom, even if it can be done on a fundamentalist conception of religion. The consequence is that the religious field became far more diversified and far more autonomous. By that I mean the traditional religious authorities everywhere lost credibility. No? Al-Azhar or the Mufti of the state everywhere. We saw a surge of individual religious entrepreneurs, of TV preachers, of small local imams with a local following, you know. We saw many youngs inventing, you know, their own kind of religiosity. The Salafi movement, which is seen as a very conservative and rightist movement, which is true, you know, is also a product of this individualization of religion, of this deculturation of religion. So, and I insist on that, you know, fundamentalism is not a return to traditional religion. It could go along with a transformation of religiosity on an individual basis. And this, it's this individualization which is common, you know, between religious transformation and a quest for democracy. But of course, there are and there will be tensions. Yeah. And here, I will stress the conundrum of the Islamist. The Islamists are now in a pluralist political scene, and they accept this pluralism. They accept elections. They accept the principle of constitution. But they cannot give up the idea that Islam should have some centrality. You know, they cannot give up this idea. You know. They cannot become secular. You know. No. If they become secular, they disappear. You know. So how, for them, how to recast the centrality of Islam into a more democratic and a more open, a more pluralistic political space? So. And the debate is about that. You know. The debate is quite tense for good reasons. In Egypt in particular, the Muslim Brothers are under pressure of the Salafis. And the Salafis don't care about democracy. They don't care about election. They don't care about constitution. They just think that, okay, we should have Sharia as the state law, and everything will be okay. The problem for the Muslim Brothers is how, you know, to oppose such a naive and simple view without being considered as traitors, as giving up the claim for a centrality of Islam in the political sphere and in the public sphere also. So what we see is an endeavor to recast, to reshape Islam under, I would say, acceptable markers in the public sphere. For instance, you know, what do we do with Islam in the constitution? Okay. There is a consensus, except for the secularists, you know, the strong secularists. There is the radical secularists, if I can say that. There is a consensus. Islam is part and parcel of the society, the state, the political life. So, but how to make it acceptable, you know, with to people who are not necessarily believers? So here the central concept is identity. If you listen to Rashid Hanouchi, the Islamist leader in Tunisia, he always speaks about identity. Islam is our national identity, the same way that Catholicism is a national identity in Italy. You know, it's a matter of identity, so it's very vague, you know, very symbolic. It doesn't necessarily entail Sharia, and for Hanouchi, it doesn't entail the implementation of Sharia. It's a reference, you know. And this idea is shared by the recently elected president, Moncef Marzouki, who has never been an Islamist, who is a leftist, a nationalist, you know, and who also for years, you know, have been supporting the idea, yes, there is an identity. And interesting, it is interesting to see that this debate on identity is on both sides of the Mediterranean. You know, what is the European identity? What is the role of religion in the European identity? And specifically in countries like Italy, Germany, and so on. So we have a mirror effect here. The second way, to give some centrality to Islam without creating an Islamic state, is to recast the norms, the Islamic norms, into universal conservative values. And it's exactly what is going on now on issues, for instance, like alcohol. No. Should we ban alcohol? It's the first question that French journalists used to ask Hanouchi and the Muslim Brothers, you know. And the answer is very interesting. There is no reference to Sharia. The reference is to public health, you know, to excess, you know. And the proposals are, well, proposals which are, could be very congruent with what exists in the USA, for instance, you know, banning the public drinking of alcohol in the streets, you know, increasing the age, you know, for having the right to buy alcohol, for instance, increasing duties, and so on, and so on, and so on. You know, making the issue of alcohol not a Sharia issue, but an issue of public order, public health, you know, and decency. You know. Same way to recast, for instance, the issue of, there is a debate now in Tunisia about single mothers, you know. And this, I think, it's a big social issue, which has been ignored, you know, for years by the governments, you know, because it's a shame. North Africa, it's a big issue. So instead of saying, oh, it's a problem of sin, these women are sinners, no, they say it's a social issue that has to be dealt with by the state, and so, and so, and so. The issue of course, a lot of these issues concentrate of women, you know, and that's a big, by definition, the big issue. Hanouchi and his party said that they will not touch, you know, the status of the family in Tunisia. But they are pushing, you know, for concepts like decency or how to fight sexual harassment, for instance, to push for more gender separation, but equality, for instance, for repression of immoral attitudes, but they say that it will be the same for men and women, and so on and so on. So we have this conservative moralization of public life, which is expressed in non-Shariatic terms, but in terms of universal moral values, like in Turkey. And I think that will be specifically in Turkey the way they will go on like that. The model is, of course, the AK party in Turkey. No. But by definition, you know, you don't manage a society just by this kind of moral norms and values. In terms of religion, they will have to deal with the de facto autonomization of the religious field. Already now, the dean of Al-Azhar University, Sheikh Al-Tayeb, said that Al-Azhar should be separated from the state. No. Of course, Al-Tayeb is not a secularist. But what he wants is institutional separation of religious institutions from the state, which is a step precisely towards the autonomization of the religious field from the political field. And this will be done because we have a plurality of of religious actors. The Sufi, the traditional Ulama, the Salafi, the Muslim Brothers. None of them is able to have the monopoly of the religious field, which was the case in Iran, for instance. And to meet the time limit, we just make some final remarks. The challenge, of course, is the economy. Yeah. They have been elected not to impose Sharia, but to improve the way the society is working. Yeah. They have no way to size the power because they don't have the military power, because the society is diverse, because they don't have the monopoly of religion, and because they need political alliances, and because their electorate is very conservative. It's, as I said, it's not a revolutionary electorate. So they have to deal with the economic situation. In economy, they are liberal, most of them. Most of the Islamists are liberal. And once again, they're looking towards the AKP model in Turkey. How to combine an economic liberalism with a conservative approach in terms of social values. For that, they have to to reinsure foreign investors, tourists, the business milieu, that everything will be okay. That there will be no revolution, and so on. It's in their interest to stabilize politically the country, not in taking power, but in institutionalizing the democratization process. And I think it's the issue now, the institutionalization of democracy. There will be some big remaining issues, and specifically in Egypt, the issue of the Christian minority. For the Muslim Brothers, there is no problem to protect a minority. So they think about the Christians in terms of a minority, under minorities' rights. And this fits with the Christian religious hierarchy. You know. Pope Shenouda, for instance, does consider that, yes, we are a minority, the Copts, and that this minority is under his own guidance, you know. But the new generation, on both sides, Christians and Muslims, have a different conception of religious affiliation. They don't see that as something which is inherited. They see that more as a choice, you know. And the big issue now in Egypt will be the debate on apostasy and conversion, you know. If the ban on apostasy is put in place, then it means that that individual freedom doesn't reach the religious field. But if apostasy is just abandoned, you know, down, and freedom of religion is defined as an individual right and not as a minority right, then we'll have, you know, a convergence between the concept of freedom in religion and the concept of freedom in democracy. So I think that it will be a very important challenge for Egypt in the next months or years. And this will be a test, you know, of the ability of the Islamists to manage, you know, the religious references and a true democratic process of building citizenship instead of just belonging. You know. Thank you very much.
Olivia, thank you very much. That was terrific. There's nothing I would disagree with, so let me just try to see if I can supplement with a few points. You know, first of all, I come to the story as a journalist, and I was in Tahrir Square for the revolution, and then I came back 6 months later, and I'm going again in a few weeks. And one day I really would love to design a journalism course just around, it would simply be called Covering Tahrir Square. Because I think it posed a unique set of journalistic challenges. And the first rule of this class would be that whenever you're seeing elephants fly, shut up and take notes, okay? That was truly my rule every day walking from my hotel to Tahrir Square. You are seeing something you have never seen before. And when you see something that is this fundamental a disruption, the overriding principle should be humility. Shut up and take notes. You didn't see it coming. What makes you know where it's going? And that's really been, I've tried to practice that principle with the whole Arab Spring. I have no idea where this is going. And the balance I found in trying to cover it is to be open to the incredible possibilities of what this represented. And at the same time, to be constructively skeptical about how it could go wrong. And to me, constructive skepticism, not cynicism, and not naivete. Those are the two boundaries you want to avoid. To me, as a journalist, you want to be right in the middle with the attitude of constructive skepticism. So that's basically how I lean into this story. And I have no idea where it's going. I just know one thing. I people say to me, what did you see in Tahrir Square? And I tell everyone, I saw three things. I saw a tiger that was living in a 5x8 cage for 50 years get released. And there's three things I will tell you about tiger. One is what Olivier said, tiger is not going back in the cage. That is for absolute sure. Second, and I think Olivier would agree with this, I'm saying it differently than he did, do not try to ride tiger. Okay. All right. That is, tiger rides for Egypt. He does not ride for the Salafist. He will not ride for the Islamists alone. He will not ride for the military alone. He will not ride for the liberals alone. Do not try to ride tiger for your own ends, exclusive of others. And I so agree with Olivier. There's a real balance of power and diversity there that is going to have to work itself out. And the third point about tiger is tiger only eats beef. This tiger has been fed an unremitting diet of every lie in the Arabic language for 50 years. Be very careful of trying to feed this tiger anything other than beef. Whether, again, you're from the army, look what the army, the difficult, oh, they put it all out on Facebook, aren't we cute? And when they started putting out non-beef on Facebook, people threw it right back in their face. And, you know, I would keep, and the people actually learned this the hard way were the generals, because their attitude was basically, they were afraid of this thing from the very beginning. Their attitude was, nice tiger, good tiger. Tiger want election, tiger get elections. Tiger want parliament, tiger get parliament. Tiger just don't eat generals the way tiger ate President Mubarak. So it seems to me they've been afraid of this thing from the very beginning. Now, a couple of what I find so fascinating about this moment is that we are going to see Islam at the governing level confront modernity in a non-oil state. And I think that every element of that is critically important, because we have seen Islam, political Islam, being basically propagated in the Middle East since the Mecca Mosque affair and the 79 revolution in Iran, from the Sunni side in this mega oil giant Saudi Arabia, and in the Shiite side from this mega oil giant called Iran. And each one, in a way, had its own Islamic revolution. Saudi Arabia, which pushed out the liberals after the Mecca Mosque affair, and which happens in 1979, and coincidentally, the Iranians pushing out the Shah in 1979. Now, why is that oil money so important? Because it allowed these Islamist regimes to buy off every contradiction. They had the resources to buy off every contradiction. Egypt will not have that luxury. Not only does it have 85 million people, but it has no oil in the ground, has a little gas, but certainly none that will allow it to buy off these contradictions. Therefore, it will have to embrace or reject or adapt to the real world as it is. And as Islamists take the political leadership in Egypt and have to confront a world in which Egypt's biggest foreign currency earner, $39 billion last year, was foreign trade, was tourism. When they have to confront a world where Egypt is now spending, basically bleeding, $1 billion in foreign currency every month, and they're now down to about $20 billion in reserves. As they confront a world where, I did a column about this, second time I came back to Egypt after the first, the big Tahrir event, I was in the airport and I was in the duty-free shop and looking at the Tutankhamun ashtrays and everything, and they had a stuffed camel there in the shop. It had a hump, and if you squeeze the hump, it honked. And I turned it over, and it said, "Made in China." Now, when you are one of the world's lowest wage countries next to Europe, and you are importing your honking humped camel from China, you have a fundamental problem, okay, of innovation, entrepreneurship, and education. And again, the more the Islamists are in power and do not have the ability to dip into oil reserves to deal with that confrontation, to deal with that, they will have to deal with the fundamental problems of integration with the global economy, education of women, okay, in a country that has about 40 to 50% illiteracy among women. Shame on President Mubarak for that statistic alone. Okay. And to deal with a global economy where the biggest value add will be from knowledge supply chains. Okay. And this is for me a very important issue because I don't look at what's going on in the Middle East, just given what I write about my interests, in isolation. You have to see it in the context of where the global economy is today. And where the global economy is today is moving from what I call connected to hyper-connected. And in this hyper-connected world, by the way, this is a huge challenge for America. So imagine what is going to be for Egypt. In this hyper-connected world, I believe the world will be divided between what I call HIEs and LIEs. Developed and developing countries is no longer the relevant metric. The world will be divided between high imagination enabling societies and low imagination enabling societies for a very simple reason. If I have the spark of an idea, if I just have this, I can now go to Delta in Taiwan. They'll design this. Skip over to Alibaba and Hangzhou, China. They'll give me a cheap Chinese manufacturer for this. Jump over to Amazon.com. They'll do my fulfillment and delivery. Craigslist will get me my account. And then Freelancer.com, which just listed their 5 millionth freelancer this week, will get me someone to design my logo. In that world, the greatest value added will be to those countries who can say, imagined in America and orchestrated in America. Imagined in China and orchestrated in China. By orchestrated is that you orchestrate the global supply chain that produces both the knowledge and manufacturing that goes into that product. Any country that wants to thrive in the world that does not have a natural resource that it can't fall back on will have to be part of imagining and orchestrating and working in these global supply chains. That's the global context within which these Islamic parties will be, I think, having to decide their economic policy, their political policy, their attitudes toward women. I think the fact that Egypt is so central to the Arab world, and Arab Islam really is at the core of Islam. And Egypt will now be led by or highly influenced by Islamic parties, and they have no oil, means you're going to see, in my view, a fascinating and highly unpredictable confrontation and synthesis between Islam and modernity, the likes of which we have not seen anywhere before. Iran and Saudi Arabia are both sideshows to this. A couple other points I would make, and then we'll just go to the dialogue. One of the things I look at is Iraq. And we do very little study of Iraq in this country because basically Iraq is such a painful experience for the United States and was so politicized that we just want to forget about it. So we just want to forget about something we spent $1 trillion on in the last 9 years, not to mention 4,800 lives, 20,000 wounded, 100,000 Iraqi casualties. But Iraq has, I think, some very interesting lessons for us to observe. One is, if you followed Iraqi politics, they had the same Salafist emergence in the Sunni community and even a Shiite variant. That is, there were ultra-religious forces lurking underneath the society that were a shock, I think, to a lot of the Iraqi emigres who came back and certainly to the Americans. The other interesting thing Iraq teaches us is look at the evolution of their politics. Islamist religious sectarian parties won the first elections, swept them. They did not perform in government, and in the next election, they were swept out and replaced by both parties running on multi-party, multi-ethnic and multi-sectarian platforms, Iyad Alawi's party, and avowedly sort of rule of law with a sectarian underpinning, to be sure, of Maliki's party. In other words, what Olivia said, I couldn't agree with more. Arabs are no different than what we want here right now. People want good government. They want clean government. They want good, safe schools for their kids to go to. And they want the electricity to go on when they flip the switch. And whether you are a Salafist, Muslim Brotherhood, army, or a raving liberal, if you cannot deliver that in any kind of democratic context, you will be voted out. And so I think one of the things is keep an eye on Iraq. We don't want to look at it, but I think it bears a lot of lessons to what's going on here. Let me just see if there's anything else that Olivia referred to the competition between the Salafists and the Muslim Brotherhood, and I think that's – I was talking to my friend Vernon Jordan the other day, and in his inimitable way, he said, Tommy, there's nothing like a church fight. And I think we're going to see eventually the mother of all church fights between the Salafists and the Muslim Brotherhood over who has basically the real monopoly of religion. I think the last thing I would say, and it really is about America's role in this. We can talk more about this in the dialogue. You know, I think the administration's handled it really pretty well. All in all, we have embraced the change. We have embraced history. I don't think they're going to make the mistake we made with Hamas in its victory in the West Bank. And I think our job is simply to keep reiterating principles that we believe in, that we think are the constituent elements of any democratic society, whether it has a large religious party component or not. We believe in free and fair elections and rotations in power. We believe in the rule of law. We believe in anti-corruption. We believe in that women should be allowed to fulfill their full potential along with every other citizen. And we believe in protecting religious diversity. I think we just have to keep repeating those principles and make it clear that our aid, our help, our friendship will be guided by those principles, whether Salafists are ruling or Muslim Brotherhood are ruling or the army is ruling or anybody else. I say that partly because I don't think we have any other choice, but I say that because I think ultimately, that's where our biggest impact can be. So with that, we'll go to the question.
Well, While we are miking up here, I would just like to point out to the people who are at the back there that if you'd like to take a load off your feet, there are still some seats available here. There are six at least at the front, and you have a special invitation from the chair to come and take a chair if you'd like to. And please don't feel embarrassed. It'll take a few minutes just to get things organized, so come take a seat.
There are three seats up here and three seats over here, right up the front. Great. Olivia, Tom, thank you for two really excellent presentations. Olivia, I wonder if I could get you to respond to one thing that Tom brought up, and that's about women's rights. How are the Islamists going to deal with women's rights? We see very clearly in terms of the Salafis that they're not willing to give them equal standing in their tickets and in the way that they treat them. So how is this going to play itself out in this incredible scene that you described?
I think this will be the line of divide between the Muslim Brothers and the Salafi. You know. Even if the Salafis make some concessions, they are starting from such, you know, a position against participation of women in the public sphere, that they will not be able to provide anything positive. The Muslim Brothers, I guess, you know, through my discussion with them and the way they are acting and so, will deflect the issue. They will not speak directly about women as such, you know. They will speak about family values, about decency, about traditions, you know. They will brought a conservative agenda concerning families, which by definition, you know, we know when somebody usually stress the importance of family, it's always at the detrimental of the position of women in the society. And it's not specific to the Islamists. You know, we have that, it's the Christian right, not necessarily in the USA, but also in Europe, is also playing on this line, you know. So I think that we'll have a convergence between the religious rights, you know, in the West as well as in the East. And here we have this process of globalization, you know. They will adopt some forms of conservative conception of societies, which are also playing a role in our society. So it's not the West, Western values versus Muslim values. It's a recasting of values on both sides in terms of more or less liberal values or more or less social conservative values.
What, one thing that your thesis would highlight for me, if I were a Saudi, is that the process that both you and Tom describe as going on in Egypt should be seen as deeply threatening to them, not just because of its democratic trend, but also because of this democratization of Islam that you describe. How, do you see how the Saudis are reacting to this? We saw some reports of Saudi funding of the Salafis, but do you have anything more that you can tell us about the way the Saudis view this?
I am not inside of Saudi politics, you know. But there are clear indications. They are supporting and subsidizing, financing the Salafi, clearly. And the Salafi now are rivals for the Muslim, for the Muslim Brothers. So the Saudis are not playing the Islamist against the secularists. No. They are playing the Salafi against the Islamist and conservative so-called secularists like the army, you know, against the Muslim Brothers too. We have a clear indication in the fact that suddenly the Egyptian Salafis decided, you know, to establish political parties, which normally is anathema for them. They always oppose Hezbollah, you know, the idea to have political parties and to go for elections and so on and so. And it's why the Salafis were able to consider that Saudi Arabia is a true Islamic country, because they just refused, you know, to go into politics. But suddenly, in some weeks, they took the incredible decision to go for politics. And there was no reaction from the shayur, the sheikh, you know, the spiritual leaders of the Salafi in Saudi Arabia. So it means that, in fact, the Saudis have given a very green light, you know, to the Salafis to enter into politics. So here we have a clear indication, you know, that the Saudis are supporting the Salafi more against the Muslim Brothers than against the secularists. Mm. But the interesting thing is that the Muslim Brothers are supported by the Qatari. You know? And Qatar has a huge role everywhere now, from Tunisia to Libya, now, and not to speak of Al Jazeera, of course, to Egypt. So we have an interesting, you know, competition for the control of the reference to Islam among the Sunnis, you know, between the Qatari and the Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia on that.
Tom, do you want to come in on the Qataris? They certainly seem to be punching above their weight in this circumstance, but as much as I love the Qataris, they're not Democrats in their instincts.
That's fascinating. What I don't think I'm on.
You're not on? Can you get the mic, Tom's mic, on, please?
Is it on? It doesn't feel like.
Try
it.
Yeah. Speak loud.
Is it on? Yeah. You know, one thing I'd simply say is that you know, I've seen this phenomenon so often in the Middle East. You know, free and fair elections are really pretty rare up to now in the Middle East, and so whenever they happen, everybody wants to vote, and not just the people in that country. So whenever there's a free election in the Arab world, trust me, everybody tries to vote. And I actually was not aware that the Qataris were supporting the Muslim Brotherhood and the Saudis. And I would also, and I'm sure there's a lot of also just free-floating money going to both, you know. But I think that the danger to Saudi Arabia, I would argue, the challenge to Saudi Arabia, if I were the Saudis, I'd be most worried about actually what's going on in Moscow right now. And I will tell you why. My view, and Olivia said this, you know, that the Tahrir Square was about three things.
So I think what Tahrir Square was about, or let's go back to Tunis and, it was first and foremost about dignity. The number of Egyptians who said to me, I was ashamed to show my Egyptian passport, was to me the most striking thing. And it's because they're living in a flat world and they can see how everybody else is living and they know how far behind they are. And that's why I've always believed that there were a lot of ancillary things. These are purely secondary. But I really do believe they fed into this revolution in unconscious ways. One was President Obama's trip to Cairo. Again, I'm not exaggerating this. It was not the cause. But these are things that fed into it. And I wrote this actually at the time of his visit, not knowing what would happen. But I said, you know, after he went, I said, you know, I bet there were more than a few young Egyptians sitting in the audience listening to President Obama and saying to themselves, wow, he's dark-skinned and I'm dark-skinned. His name's Barack and my name's Barack. His grandfather's a Muslim and my grandfather's a Muslim. He's president of the United States, and I can't vote. And I have a feeling that that was one of the very subtle things working in the background. I'll tell you another subtle thing working in the background. Had a huge impact on me. The Chinese Olympics. Now, if you're sitting in Egypt, and you're thinking, we were ahead of China in 1950.
We were ahead of China.
Probably in 1960. And you watch the opening and closing ceremonies of the Chinese Olympics. Well, that's one of the things that makes you ashamed to show your Egyptian passport. Okay? So first, this was about dignity. Second, it was about justice. What was the first thing they did? They burned down the police stations, the symbols of injustice, and the NDP headquarters. and it had not been ringed by layers of tanks, they would have burned down that TV tower. Man, they could not wait to get to that beacon of lies. Okay, this was secondly about justice. And third, it was about democracy, but as Olivia said, I think very widely defined about controlling my life, the ability to control my life. I was so struck. Alaa Aswani, the great Egyptian author, said to me something that week about what was behind the revolution. He said, we so resented the idea of Mubarak handing us over to his sons as if we were chickens that could be handed by a father to a son. And we had a story in the New York Times on Sunday quoting one of the leading Russian bloggers, the one who's in jail, as saying, Putin treated us like we were cattle and sheep. I'm telling you, this, and the third thing I would say, this democracy thing, what really struck me was that, you know, I got there shortly after the attempts to crush the rebellion by the guys on the camels and the horses and whatnot. And people forget they lost 800 kids in that, according to Amnesty International, a lot more than we realized. And first day there were small wallet-sized pictures of them around the square. Next day there were bigger pictures. And by the third day they were wall-sized banner pictures of the martyrs, the shuhada. And I just walked around there and I thought, that's interesting. See, I've seen martyrs for Islam. I've seen martyrs against America. I've seen martyrs against Israel. I've never seen martyrs for democracy. But I want to say this one last thing. You put those three together, dignity, justice, and that desire to control your own life, and I tell you, they beat in the heart of every Arab, including Saudis. And that's why I think they can pay, they can send money, I think this is going to be a huge problem for Saudi Arabia, because those three things are not feelings confined to Egypt.
Sorry. Great. So let's just pick up on your last point. They weren't burning the American flag in Tahrir Square. You said in your lecture that they're not looking for confrontation with the West. Are they looking for confrontation with Israel? How does the Palestinian factor play into their calculations? You didn't really talk about what their foreign policy might be. You seem to portray them as really focused on domestic politics. But what about that foreign factor with the West and Israel?
They focus on domestic politics, but they are caught by geostrategic context. So revolutions were successful where the geostrategic context was minimum, in Tunisia, for instance. So Tunisia has no other option in terms of foreign policy. Another discourse, maybe, but not a real alternative. Egypt, paradoxically, the same. You know, the red line is the peace treaty. The Muslim Brothers certainly hate Israel. There is no doubt about that. But they are caught by the constraints. They know that if they go, you know, for an escalation against Israel, they are done because they will be unable to deliver the goods in Egypt. So they will do nothing. The discourse will change, certainly. Certain form of secret collaboration will disappear, but they will not fight for the Palestinians. The problem is different in Bahrain, in Syria, and even in Yemen, because there, any movement of contestation is automatically interpreted in terms of a change in the geostrategic balance. You know, we know that if there is the success of a democratic movement in Syria, well, the whole balance of power in the Middle East will change. You know, and it will be a tremendous change. So, in this context, there is less room for, I would say, a genuine democratic movement, because whatever they do, it will be interpreted. Whatever anybody does, it will be interpreted in terms of geostrategic. Now, And it's a big problem for Iran, for instance. Iran, since the revolution, Iranian revolution, 30 years ago, has always played the Arab streets, you know, against the Arab regimes and against the West. The problem now for Iran, if the Arab street is successful in Syria, then Iran will lose its highway to the Mediterranean, its highway to Hezbollah. No. So it will be a huge strategic defeat for Iran. But on the other hand, if Iran is endorsing, you know, the repression of the democratic movement in Syria, Iran will not be able now to call the Arab street to rise up against which regimes, you know, to protect Iran. So in the context of the threat of a bomb, of a bombing of Iran, it's very, very important, you know. So Iran is also the losers in these circumstances.
And what about the United States? Do you agree with Tom that we've handled it the right way?
Yeah, you know, in fact, there is two obstacles to democracy, oil and foreign military. Yeah. So in Iraq, I'm not very hopeful. So they have no more foreign military, but they still have oil, you know. In Saudi Arabia, they have both. But in Tunisia, it's good. No oil, no foreign military, so I'm optimistic.
And Libya, they in Libya, they have oil.
In Libya, they have oil and some foreign military intervention. So, you know, on my scale, you know, Libya, I'm not so optimistic.
Yeah, Martin, I would say one thing about the Israel point, and agree with what Olivia said, that there, it obviously has not been a priority, not been a central thing. But I think the really important point is, if there were, God forbid, a third sort of huge conflagration between Israelis and Palestinians in the West Bank, there are no firewalls anymore. Mubarak was a huge firewall. Assad was a huge firewall. The King of Jordan is a huge firewall. And they absorbed the whole war of Hezbollah into them. They closed down the embassy. They didn't pull the ambassador back. They absorbed the Gaza war. They are not there. And therefore, the fire, I think, would spread just incredibly fast. And that's why Israel and the Palestinians must not play with matches.
Do you agree with that?
I would say in theory, yes. In practice, no. Mm-hmm. I think, in fact, that there is a process of political maturation among the people. When you vote, you know, you are more aware, or at least a part of the electorate is more aware of the political implications. My view is that the Israelo-Palestinian conflict is less and less central to the geostrategy of the Middle East. And the democratization process will make this conflict more and more less central. But the growing conflict is Shia Sunnis, you know, is Saudi Arabia versus Iran. You know. And the democratization process is accentuating, you know, the Shia Sunnis conflict, because precisely it's giving more power to the Sunnis in Syria, and it could give more power to the Shias in Bahrain.
And in Iraq? It's to power to both.
In Iraq, so the, you have a Shia power now in Iraq. It's done. Yeah.
Let's go to the audience for some questions. I would ask you, please, to wait for the microphone, identify yourself, and please ask a question. Let's go to the back first, down there, the lady at the back.
Good evening. My name is Lieutenant Commander Zoe Sherman with the U.S. Navy. I have two questions for you. First, you had made mention of, obviously, as a recap, social change, major social change going on, economic trade changes, political changes. This introduces a whole host of security challenges and fundamental shifts in the traditional balances that have occurred in the Middle East and the greater Islamic region worldwide. My question, number one, is how do you see the security environment in that region changing? Number two, they're not looking for confrontation with the West yet. I heard that reference made earlier. Will there be a point where the West risks becoming vulnerable to the gaze again? In other words, what do we need to do to prevent being front and center to the confrontation?
Go ahead, Henri.
Security environment. Well, it depends of what you call security environment, you know. If you mean the risk of conflicts, you know, yes, there will be conflicts, but it will be not be directly against the West. It will more be it will be more between proxies of Saudi Arabia and Iran, for instance. So in terms of terrorism and things like that, I think that will have a decrease. You know, it's already in the way. You know, Al Qaeda was out of the picture from the beginning. You know, and Al Qaeda is only on the margins. So the more you have a process of democratization, the less you have a danger of a marginal individual radicalization. You know. And about the West, I think that the West should not interfere. The West should be open, you know, have relationship on a bilateral dimension, but the West should avoid this kind of global and useless statement about Islam and democracy, about radicalization, about terrorism, and so on. So just let's be more pragmatic and open to the precise context of every conflict.
You know, I would just say that I think the biggest security issue, and it's not just for the West, it's mostly for Arabs and Muslims. There's a line that was used in Russia in the 1990s after the Russian Revolution, which was been pointed out to me the other day, that it's a lot easier to take an aquarium with fish and turn it into fish soup than it is to turn fish soup into an aquarium with fish. And so what you're seeing now across the Arab world is aquariums with fish being turned into fish soup. Turning that fish soup back into a stable aquarium where all the fish can coexist, you know, in a nice, you know, kind of structure is going to be, I believe, a challenge that will be with us for many, many years. First of all, it's their security challenge and it's their security opportunity. But you know, my motto is stability has left the building in the Arab world. We are now going to deal with two kinds of instability. One, under a microscope, the wave will look like that, but it'll have a positive slope, hopefully, leading toward a kind of Indonesia-South Africa transition to democracy. And another option is a wave that looks like that will have a negative slope leading toward a Pakistan or, God forbid, Somali alternative. And it will be different in every country. They'll all be different, given their culture and history and whatnot. But I think that's going to be the real challenge, is going to be state building, institution building, that can deliver for their people in a world of democratized expectations and aspirations, starting already in a hole. Because you have a huge cohort of people in these countries who I call the educated unemployed, who also aren't that educated. Not to their fault. I'm a big believer brains are distributed equally, but the educational institutions in these countries have not prepared these young people to compete at a critical mass level that they need to be. And so there's got to be a real upgrading of the educational systems as well. And this is going to be a huge, I think, leadership challenge. And as I say, it's going to be done in countries with no oil and with maybe less and less foreign aid, given what's going on with the European Union and the United States.
Yes, halfway down there.
Hugo Einstaff. But for the last 15 to 20 years, all I've heard about the Middle East is revolutions, revolutions, because of jobs. With the population, I think about 60% being under the age of 25. How do you get the jobs? Otherwise, you're going to have Arab Springs, but it's going to be the opposite way. It's going to be that the inequality that existed before is still going to exist, because what corporations are going to go in there? And was Shelley Talami, when he was here and gave the report on what leaders are admired most, Obama finished after Hugo Chavez. Mm-hmm. So there's this thing we think of that Americans are admired, but it's kind of different on the street sometimes.
Yeah. How do they get the jobs?
I think this is a huge challenge, and it's why I emphasize when I look at this phenomenon, the global context. If you think of the last really period of plasticity in the Arab world, the 50s and early 60s, when you had coup after coup after coup, you know, this was an age of protected economies. It was a world of walls. It was a superpower divided world where each one could fund the other and prop up states, basically. And expectations were low. You didn't know what was going on, basically, anywhere else. Now this second wave in our lifetimes of enormous... So then that was followed by a period of rigidity, of solid states, basically funded by oil, security states funded by oil and by the Cold War. And now that's been broken down. But unlike the change that... It's broken down as if there had been a war. We're seeing the kind of breakdown of states that normally follows a World War I, a World War II, or the end of the Cold War, as we saw in Eastern Europe. This breakdown is driven by one thing, in my view, the merger of globalization and the IT revolution. That's the whirlwind here, all right? Because it's created this huge democratization of information, of tools, of aspiration, of commerce, et cetera. And so this jobs question is going to be a huge problem for us, for America, for Europe, for France, because the stress that it puts on individuals to compete globally. And so it's going to be quadrupled, you know, in a country that hasn't really had to face that kind of competition. And I think it's going to be the real elephant in the room, basically.
Olivia, on jobs?
Yeah, I think that there are some potentialities. For instance, precisely because of this new generation. As I said, they are more educated, more open, more global. They travel. And if they have more opportunity in terms of opening both the political market and the economic market, there is a potentiality for instance, for the coming back of second-generation migrants. We have this phenomenon already from Morocco, for instance, from France. You have second-generation, third-generation Moroccans who go back. But they are engineers or they are businessmen, and they go back to Morocco. The result of the Tunisian elections at the consulate in San Francisco were the same than in Tunisia, you know. But the Tunisians in San Francisco, they are Silicon Valley. They are not, you know, cleaners or room cleaners or workers like that. They are intellectuals and they voted for Nahda too, you know. So they might have something in mind doing that. I think that this wave of democratization can go on with a wave of a creation of small business, for instance, you know, in the area. One of the big problems in Tunisia was the kleptocracy. You know, the fact that it was totally, you couldn't open a successful business without being robbed, you know, by the family, you know, in the weeks following your first economic successes. You know. So it's not enough, you know, but it's part of the picture, too.
Last question, I'm afraid, down here.
Hi, Rachel Oswald. You both mentioned that you're generally supportive of the administration's policy toward the Arab awakenings, but what about the cards it does have on the table? What about the billions of dollars in aid it provides to SCAF annually and, you know, the stationing of the fleet in Bahrain? If SCAF refuses, you know, to give power to, you know, the elected parliament and involves itself in the constitution, and if the Bahrain monarchy does not end its prosecution of protesters, you know, and discrimination, what do you think the Obama administration should do on those two issues?
Yeah, I would just say I don't know enough about the options on the Bahrain situation, but I'd say as far as the SCAF is concerned, I think they've done a pretty good job of leaning into them, you know, basically, to keep this process going forward. If it were to come to an abrupt halt, it would, to some degree, fall out of the hands of the administration into Congress. which appropriates the foreign aid. And that could lead to very unfortunate, because there you're going to get a lot of politics mixed up in it. You know, I felt from the beginning that one of the things that we should do is do something radically different. And that is, we give the Egyptian army, I think it's about $1.3 billion a year. And one of the things I would love to see the administration do, and it could really play to Obama's, you know, sort of identity, is I'll simply say, we're going to take $100 billion of that. $100 million. Because Egypt has no predators today. Its only predators are poverty and ignorance. And you don't need more F-16s. So we're going to take $100 million of that, and we're going to build 50 science and technology high schools from Aswan to Alexandria, in collaboration with you, at your, you know, instruction. Where you want them to go, we will fund them. And this is in honor of the revolution. That's our way of honoring it. I think we need to do something that's actually in tune with the real aspirations of young Egyptians, which I don't think is for another set of F-16s, but it's to be given the tools and opportunity to compete, connect, and collaborate with everyone else in the world. So that would be my piece of advice.
Olivia, let me just finish by asking you about the SCAF, because you're focused on the Islamists. But, and you basically have a fairly rosy picture of how things are going to evolve there in a positive way in terms of democracy. But the SCAF is not democratic.
No.
The pressures on it are somewhat different. Yeah. So,
and their war with the Muslim Brotherhood goes a long way back.
So how does the SCAF play in this game?
I think the SCAF played very clumsily during the events, you know. And they discredited the army, discredited itself during the last events. Now Egypt needs a strong army. Population is not against, you know, to having a strong national army. So the problem is now for the army to go the same way that the Turkish army, you know, keeping, you know, going back to the barracks, but of course staying as a strong national army. If the SCAF is not encouraged, you know, by external actors to go against the Muslim Brothers, I think they will have no choice than to play along the rules. And the Muslim Brothers and the army, as you know, the good old enemies, they know each other perfectly. You know, they know how not to go too far. They know they have channels of communication. You know, so I think if there is no foreign pressure, they will find a way. But the army, I think, is the losers until now, because they play badly. And for Bahrain, it's another story, because here we are back to the big confrontation, you know, between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And here the Americans cannot be neutral, you know. So here we have, it's one of the cases where geostrategy is more important than democratization.
Olivia, Tom, I think that Raymond Aron, if he were able to listen to you, would be very happy to have this lecture series named after him. You've done him proud, and you've done Brookings proud by a really excellent lecture and conversation, and we're very grateful to both of you. Thank you very much.